Attention.
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 Rosetta Stone invites you to be a part of its biggest language learning event in history. Because in 2011, we want to help 3 million people learn a new language. That's why we're going to give you an absolutely free demo of our language immersion technology. Call 1-800-522-1164. Developed to fully immerse you in your new language, the Rosetta Stone solution is easier than ever before. For your free demo, call 1-800-522-1164. 1-800-522-1164.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hour with your host, Pope Runyon. Now, tonight we're featuring a discussion on the magic of nature. I will begin by explaining that the Hermetic tradition, unlike Gnosticism, is a blend of natural and transcendental magical perspectives and methods. Therefore, we can include such subjects as sacred landscapes, landforms, flora and fauna, and humankind's relation to the ecosystem as an integral part of our philosophy and our workings. Now, of course, the best example of the nature-oriented Western magic is Fred Adams' Feritheria, which we will again visit in our discussion. And we'll have the Avatrix of Feritheria. Joe Carson will be calling in, and we'll get into Fred's magical landforms. And we'll also cover ley lines. I think we misspelled that in the abstract. It's L-E-Y, ley lines. And sacred sites and the connection of celestial aspects with seasonal changes, connecting the greater universe with the sphere of nature and the earth-sky love body of the goddess herself. Known to the Renaissance Magi as the Anima Mundi. Now, tune in, and we'll go outdoors for inspiration this time. Now, I said I was going to stop using that. Okay. I said that we would explain that the Hermetic tradition, unlike Gnosticism, is a blend of natural and transcendental magical perspectives and methods. This is true because Hermeticism is a mixture, as we've described before. It's a mixture of Gnosticism and Neoplatonism, and it uses both perspectives. And it also owes something to the Mithriatic initiatory cult. So, when they put this together, the Hermetic tradition came together in Alexandria around the time of Christ. They had a desire to include both the heavens and the transcendental aspect and the earth as one sacred whole. Now, this is Neoplatonic, which goes back to actual Platonic, Plato, who was a Pythagorean. It goes back to Pythagoras. And if you get earlier than Pythagoras and Empedocles, you get into the Orphic tradition, which is a mystical tradition in ancient Greece, not where the soul ascended to the realm of the stars. And as you recall, the Milky Way is the river of souls. And as you also recall, Hermetic philosophy, stemming all the way from Orphic philosophy, is grounded in astrology. And astrology is worldwide, even though it takes different forms and different systems, it's worldwide and it's very, very ancient. Now, one of the things that I want to really make clear tonight, because we're having a revival in this country and in the Western world, we're having a revival of shamanism. I've been reading Andre Zanaminsky's wonderful book, The Beauty of the Primitive, which we're going to hopefully discuss on a future broadcast, in which he covers the whole history of shamanism and modern anthropological approach to shamanism, all the way from the Siberian shamans all the way through to the shamans of the Amazon and Carlos Castaneda's Don Juan, whether you believe him or not. And all the way through, Andre has done this wonderful survey of shamanism and concluding that we have a rebirth of shamanism, and it's actually not just one tribe. The anthropologists turned shamans, Michael Harner primarily, have created a core shamanism. That aspect of shamanism, which is universal. Now, what I'm not going to say they're missing this, but we have to realize when we start looking at the core of this sort of thing, we have to realize, or we should realize, I hope, that primitive man was not as primitive as we like to think he was. Primitive people, before reading and before the alphabet, before literacy, they memorized. And they used poetry. And they used poetry in order to make sure that people would remember exactly. If you rhyme it, then you remember it. Because you know the things got to rhyme. So, and then those old shamans back in what we call prehistoric times, those old shamans, they could go on for hours and hours and never miss a word of the ancient mysteries that they were perpetuating and passing on in their culture. This, in some ways, I am afraid we're losing this maybe in this modern movement where the idea is to be experiential. The idea is to be Dionysian, be experiential, find yourself within, which is fine, and that's good. That's part of the whole process. Go in there and meet your power animal, and go and discover your inner self, and find out what the plants have to tell you, and all that. That's fine. That's good. You should, and shamans do. But they also, if they are in this ancient heritage, they also have a cannon. And I don't mean a cannon that you load with powder. I mean a corpus of knowledge. Remember, Don Juan Matus was a man of knowledge. Whether Carlos invented him or not, I mean, he's a man of knowledge. And therefore, the shamans were, in most ancient times, they were the culture bearers. Now, Astrology was one of the earliest of man's intellectual efforts. Why? Because ancient people, hunters and gatherers, the first agriculturalists, the herdsmen, they looked up at the sky. And the sky was a lot better to look at in those days, I'll tell you, because we didn't have the smog and all that stuff. And the city lights or whatever, they looked up at the sky and they saw how the seasons changed in accordance with the sky. They looked at the Big Dipper and they said, oh, the Big Dipper, the tail of the bear, because they called it a bear, of course, with a long stretched tail. The tail of the bear points to the seasons, and when the tail of the bear points directly down to the solstice point, then we know, you know, that the time for planting has come, and all this. And this became, and I believe, now, I may be wrong, and there are some people who will go along with me, that this cult of the North Star, this cult of the Great Bear, that this was the first religion. This was the oldest religion. Now, if that's true, then the relation between the earth and the landforms and the flora and the fauna and the seasons and the animals and everything is connected to the stars. Now, that can get to be a fairly sophisticated concept. And I want to suggest a book for those of you who want to get sophisticated, and I hope some of you do. I want to suggest a book that really started off this whole recovery of celestial magic in relation to the earth. It's a book that came out in 1970, called Hamlet's Mill. Very big, thick book. It was by Professor De Santayana and Professor Van Dekkant. De Santayana was a professor of scientific history at MIT, and Hertha Van Dekkant was an anthropologist at another university, and the two of them put together this magisterial work. And the idea was to very carefully and very, very circumspectly, almost too much circumspection actually, to put together enough evidence that would convince a reasonably intelligent person, knowledgeable person, that the creation of the zodiac and was not just 4,500 years ago, as we thought, bullseye Taurus, you know, whatever it was. Does start. It starts in Aldebaran. Of course, it starts in Aldebaran, and we thought it started 4,200 or something or other years ago, but what De Santayana and Van Dekkant were out to prove, and they presented enough evidence to where it staggered some people, the amount of evidence that they, and they realized that the origin, the very ancient origins of the zodiac go back earlier than just when the eye of the bull happened to be at vernal equinox 4,200 years ago. It's more like 22,000 years ago, something like that. Anyway, the point being here that all astrology is a relationship, a mythological extrapolation of what's going on in the heavens that will affect or time with what's going on in the earth. It's primarily seasonal. That's why the precession of the equinoxes wasn't all that important, because astrology is seasonal. And it's related to the seasons and their effect on the earth. And this was something that those old shamans really developed, a very sophisticated system. And the difference, of course, we don't realize this too much today because we have telescopes. Oh boy, we have Hubble and we have these telescopes, and so we know, of course, that the Earth revolves around the sun. It isn't the other way around. So these poor people, they thought the sun revolved. So that that means that their whole system was invalid. No, it doesn't. It does not mean that at all. And this is one of the things that Hertha von Decken and de Santa Anna wanted to point out, that that doesn't matter. What matters is how it works. Because from their perspective, the Earth is what we are on. Mother Earth is where we are. We're walking on dear Mother Earth, okay? This is where we are. So as far as we're concerned, the sun is revolving around us. And that's perfectly valid for what we're trying to do. And you can build on that a very, very usable, a very usable and workable construct. Now, how did all this get, how did we lose all this? And how did we lose the relationship of the heavens to the earth? And also, how did we lose our beautiful conception of living with nature and living with the landforms and living in harmony with nature? How did we lose all this? What was it? What happened where we lost it? When did it happen? Well, when it happened was a thing called the Enlightenment, and that's, you know, I hate to call it the Enlightenment because I think maybe we ought to start calling it the De-Lightenment. It's like the firefly that flew into the electric fan and said, delighted no end. Because in the Enlightenment, all of these Pythagorean ancient concepts just flown out. Copernicus said that we revolve around the sun. Okay, let's throw out astrology, throw out everything, all of these concepts that were based on philosophy and on logic, at least poetic logic, and all of this got thrown out. This was a terrible mistake. We're now finding out that Pythagoras and Plato and the rest of them were right. And we're finding that out by leaps and bounds. But during the so-called Enlightenment, 1700, something around in there, why are they pulling all this stuff out? It's nothing but science. Unless we can replicate it, we can measure it, we can chop it up into little increments, and then we can make sure that we can do the same thing again, then it doesn't exist. And, of course, Descartes was one of the people we pinned this on. Rene Descartes actually wasn't a occultist. He was interested in alchemy. He was looking around trying to find the Rosicrucians and everything else. But Descartes was responsible for separating the imagination and putting the imagination off to the side. And he was responsible for that. And so we call that kind of view Cartesian. That's the keynote of the Enlightenment. Well, we really ended up throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Now, today we're recovering. Today we're really recovering our awareness that, especially with Einstein's theory of relativity and with quantum physics, we're beginning to return to this pre-Enlightenment perspective. And realize that these people were right. The important thing about this is, in relation to landforms and relation to nature magic, is that hermetic magic embraces this. Hermetic magic is not anti-nature. And Gnosticism was. Gnosticism was a development of the first urban revolution. And the cities were, in those days, just starting to get urban sprawl. And we were just starting to get anomie. And we were starting we separated these people from the farms. And they came in from the farms and the rural areas. And so they couldn't relate to the seasons anymore. They couldn't relate to nature anymore. They're sitting in the cities. And that's where Gnosticism really gets started, with this negative attitude that nature and the world is bad, and it's ruled by this evil demiurge. and sometimes some Gnostics thought that that devil demiurge was synonymous with Jehovah, and you know, and of course they had with some of Jehovah's utterances, they might have had a point there, but the idea was that we got to get away from this. We're slaves on a prison planet, and that was their perspective. That was Gnosticism, and yet Gnosticism had some very good transcendental concepts and some concepts which we use. But Hermeticism was a mixture of the Gnostic transcendentalism and the Pythagorean Platonic appreciation of nature. And that's why I say, of course, that Fred Adams, my master, I say Fred Adams was a Hermetic magician, and I think if Fred was here, he would agree, because he was steeped in this Western tradition, which does venerate nature. You know, Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake in 1613 or something like that. They burned poor Giordano Bruno at the stake. Well, the common idea is that poor old Giordano was burned at the stake because he told the Inquisition that that Copernicus was right. No, that's not why they burned him at the stake. He did tell the Inquisition he thought Copernicus was right. But then he said, and therefore the sun is God. And that's why they burned him at the stake. But the sun, if the sun is God, then the earth is goddess. And the Renaissance magicians were very, very much aware of that. And they created a construct called the Anima Mundi, the world spirit. And the world spirit was female. And this is really the essence of the great tantra of Hermeticism, that the earth is the goddess and the sun represents the god and the god force, and the earth it represents and the moon represent the female forces. Now, we can't do very much about the sun. Well, you know, we can't, you know, the sun's there, and hopefully it'll stay with us, and hopefully it won't give us any more skin cancer than, you know, hopefully it'll be coming up every morning. We can't do much about it, but we sure can do a lot to help poor Mother Earth. And I mean Mother Earth right now. Not only is, you know, you've heard the joke, well, Mother Nature, boy, she is ticked off. I could use a more pungent word than that, but this is a family show. And yet, Mother Nature also is crying for help. And we have, this is another aspect of this enlightenment that we had, was, oh, let's run out and cut down all the trees. Oh, let's go out and have commerce, and yeah, we're going to do all this stuff, and we're gonna build mills, and we're going to build foundries, and we're going to pollute the air, and we're going to, but that's okay, because it'll go on forever, and we don't mind. We'll dig all the coal, bring up all the oil. We just keep building and building and building and doing and doing and doing and throwing garbage and doing all this stuff, and we just keep it up. Well, yeah, so for a while, that seemed to work. Yeah, for a while it seemed to work. But you know, I don't want to sound like Oswald Spengler right now, although I like Oswald Spengler, and that Decline of the West is a very important book, which we all should at one time or another we all ought to read. But I'm going to make a statement now that may resonate with some of you. I hope it does. When did the Enlightenment really end? When did we wake up? When? World War I, people. That was it. That was when the thinking people, the thinking, intelligent, enlightened people realized that we had brought it to its final horrible conclusion. And here we thought we were so civilized. And we were telling all these third world countries and all these our colonial charges, we're civilized. We're going to bring you civilization. We're going to bring you clean plumbing and electric lights. And we're going to do all this stuff for you. And then comes World War One. And the third world looked, and we took these people from the third world, and we put uniforms on them, and we put rifles in their hands, and we said, get in the trenches and die for us, along with millions and millions and millions and millions of young men and women, too, who died pointlessly, ridiculously, stupidly. World War One was a horrendous event, more so than World War Two. Because World War II was actually just an extension of World War I. World War I woke us up. World War I told us, this civilization of ours isn't working. We aren't any more civilized, and we aren't any better than the worst savages we could ever imagine. And we've slaughtered our people by the millions, and for what? For nothing. Slaughtered them. And then, mercifully, what ended World War One? That wasn't the Balfour Declaration. It wasn't the Armistice. What ended World War One was Mother Nature herself. She had enough. She created a tremendous influenza epidemic, which was just about as bad as the war. But of course, it grows from the war. So that ended World War One, and right there, after World War One. You remember we had what was called the Lost Generation? That's when the intellectuals and the writers and the thinkers and the poets, that's when we began to realize there's something wrong here. There's something terrible going on here. Something we got to stop. Something we've got to start looking at. We've got to start re-examining our whole idea of civilization. We have to start getting along with nature and getting along with each other and getting along with, and I have to say this, and I don't mean, I'm not anti-Christian, believe me, I'm not. I think Jesus had some wonderful philosophy, none of which Christians follow, but I mean, I'm not anti-Christian at all, but I must say that World War One was referred to by many philosophers as the War of the Christians. These were Christian nations slaughtering each other. This mass slaughter, pointless mass slaughter, for what? For 200 yards of ground, you lose 200,000 men in 2 days, and we're doing it for God. Yeah, this Carl Jung said this, Arnold Toynbee said this, the wars of the Christians, and so this our neo-pagan movement and our environmental movement are our love of the goddess, our desire, our intense, deep desire to change this, the way this Western civilization has developed, has come out of this war. And as I say, World War II was just an extension of it. Now, after the influenza epidemic, they had to take a rest. They had to. And then they started it right all over again in 1939 and went right back at it. And so now finally, we're getting to the point where we realize when our resources are dwindling, our air is polluted, our climate is fouled up, we've had the worst storms and earthquakes and heat waves, and our the oceans are rising, we are in trouble. We don't have the resources, we don't have the food, we don't have... And not only that, if we keep doing this globalization the way we're going, this run by corporations, if we keep doing this, what's going to happen when the third world, each third world family produces as much garbage as the average American family? What's going to happen then? Well, we're going to have to be looking over piles of garbage everywhere we go. And according to general systems theory, that's another one you guys can mark down if you want to read. Von Bertalanffy's general systems theory is, as far as I'm concerned, that's That's the going theory of the present age, in my opinion, that we have to look at in the situation in the world today. And according to von Bertalanffy, he says, an organism cannot exist in its own excrement. Think about that. An organism. And general systems theory postulates that the human race is one, it looks at it as one organism. We look at everything in an organic analog. And an organism cannot exist in its own excrement. That's where we're at right now. So we have to take some measures. Now, in the old canon, the old canon of nature, the landforms and the flora and the fauna were all considered to be sacred and proper. And when did we start realizing that ancient man, these so-called primitive shamans, you know, they're out there beating on the drum and dancing around and howling. When did these primitive shamans, what did they do with the landforms back in prehistoric times? Well, we didn't realize this until about 1650. A fellow went out by the name of Aubrey, I believe, and he went out in southern England and was strolling about in the Avery area, Avonbury, and suddenly he realized that he was standing on a hilltop and he was looking at a huge temple structure, gigantic, stretched over miles, a big, huge temple. And all he could see the rocks sticking up from the moss and he's sticking to me. And he realized this. And the Avonbury complex was discovered. And this was prehistoric. Well, it was discovered, but then of course we had Stonehenge, of course. But this wasn't really the extent of this whole thing. It wasn't realized until 1920, when a man by the name of Albert Watkins had a similar vision, similar to Aubrey's. He was out walking around in England, and all of a sudden, he had some sort of X-ray vision, and he could see right through the hills. And he could see the hills were connected, and there is a church steeple, and it's lined up with another church steeple on another hill, and then there's these paths that keep going on, and they're all connected. And he could see all of this, like in a flash. So then he started investigating. He got maps, and he realized that all of these sites, these hilltops and these sites, they were all lined up. They had been surveyed that way by somebody back in prehistoric times because the Christian churches were built on top of the old pagan temples. So the more Watkins got into this, the more he discovered, and he wrote a book called The Old Straight Track. Well, he published it, but nobody in the scientific community wanted to even look at it. And in fact, he couldn't even get an advertisement for it in a scientific journal. Now, interestingly enough, this in the 1960s, of course, we began to really get into this again. And I'm looking at a beautiful little book here, and I think it's probably still available in a reprint, and I hope it is. If it isn't. And this book's called The View Over Atlantis, and it's by John Michel. Now, this book covers Avery's discovery, and it covers Watkins, and it covers feng shui, the Chinese system, which we'll talk about in a minute. And it really gets into the depth of this prehistoric network that was laid out not just with the landforms on the landforms, but also along lines of the celestial universe. They lined up these sacred sites with the stars. So they would have sighting arrangements that you could see when the vernal equinox was on the horizon. It would be right through the menhirs, and you could look up and see them. And the tombs were laid out this way. This was a network that was vast, and it was in harmony with nature. Now, you remember when the Enlightenment came about, they just said, oh, we have to have ships. Let's cut down the whole forest. And that's why in England, they want to cut down Sherwood Forest. Again, that's about the only forest they've got left. But we had an oak forest in Europe, stretched all the way from Poland all the way to Ireland, an oak forest. In the Enlightenment, they cut them all down, make ships out of them. And of course, those ships all blasted away at each other and all sank. But in those days, when the original prehistoric sacred site network and the ley lines were established, they had a reverence for nature. Oh, sure, they could have farms, but there wasn't any mass clear cutting or anything like this. That just didn't go on. And we have to get back to that because, quite frankly, without trees, we're going to have a bad time. You know, trees are very important to your health. They're wonderful, wonderful producers of oxygen. And in fact, our cities should have more trees in them than they have buildings, actually, if we really wanted to do things right. I'm going to read a little section from Fred Adams' book. Joe, if you're there, why don't you give us a call? Why don't you give us a call in? Because if I must start talking about Fred, I'd rather have you. I'd rather have you talk about it in some depth. But while I'm waiting for you to call, I'm going to get into the big book here. We have Joe has compiled two great big huge books of Periphrian wisdom and knowledge, and they're really impressive. And I'm getting into the first one here. And what I want to do is I want to read a section. Fred Adams is not. His writing is, it's a little hard to follow because he uses a lot of poetic metaphor and what have you. But he is the master when it comes to this sort of thing. Now, what Fred developed was a yoga of connecting with the ley lines. And connecting with the landforms. And this yoga that he developed was called SEISMIA, which is seismia, and you can immediately realize that that has some relation to seismic. And I'll read this article of Fred's here from Corathalia and try to interpret it wherever necessary. Seismia is a magical discipline for charging the body with earth waves. In more technical terms, seismian practices, if successful, may result in a field coupling of earth and body waves. To some extent, of course, this coupling... I've got a call. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, it's Joe Carson.
Oh, hi, Joe. I was just starting to read the article on ley line seismia, but I just started, so I will hold off on that and tell us. Have you been listening so far? Is what I've been covering?
Yeah, I have, and I wanted to say something about trees because you were talking
about. Please do say something about trees. Go ahead.
Well, I've been really inspired lately by reading one of Fred's favorite books called The Recovery of Culture by H. Bailey Stevens. And he really goes into, there was this whole, more than what we think of as prehistoric, but way prehistoric evolution of humans through, you know, the, what we would call similar to great apes, and eventually we became very human, but it happened over a course of many millions of years. And only during even the last million years were we sort of proto-human. And this is a period of time that people don't even talk about. I mean, we live in trees. At this point, it was before the great ice ages, and we lived, you know, surrounded by the beauty of all these fruiting trees, and we lived on a fruitarian and nut and shoot diet. And so this is kind of the paradise that, you know, it was a very social situation. You know, there was a lot of interaction. We built a lot of culture up there in the trees, and eventually we did come down out of the trees, obviously, and gained a lot, you know, from doing that. We learned, obviously, how to plant trees, for one thing. But what happened is that, as you were pointing out, that there was a long history of people looking up to the sky for religion and for astrology and for cues about the seasons and how important that was for planting. But even before that, we were looking to trees as our source. And many cultures, even to very recent times, as recently as 100 years ago, perpetuated stories and legends of that humans literally came out of trees, and you know, there's a lot of examples in the book about that. Like in Indonesia, there's one that literally has the first man, the first woman stepping forth out of a huge bamboo tree. And there's many cultures where a village is has a sacred tree at the center of it. And this, you know, you can still find this today in many parts of the world. And trees, you know, naturally they go so deep and they reach up so high into the sky that we have our sacred trees like Yggdrasil and the Tree of Life, representing sort of the combination of that which is above and that which is below.
Well, absolutely. In fact, Yggdrasil is a perfect example of that. And I just was kind of depressed when I went up the Lost Coast area north of where you folks are, and I got in there, and there's this little patch of redwoods, just this little patch of redwoods. You drive through them on the way to Honeydew and whatever, and then after that, you look at these hillsides where the redwoods used to be, and they're all clear cut. And it's just like, it's almost like a moorland. It's heartbreaking. And I, one thing I will say, a lot of people look at Redfield's Celestine Prophecy and his Celestine Vision as a, they look at it as a kind of a, you know, popular corny thing or whatever. No, I personally think that Redfield is a little fable is just as important as some of Castaneda's constructs. And Redfield has almost a Farfarian vision. He's a little less, drastic than the Farfarian paradisial vision. But he thinks that we ought to be living in the middle of forests, literally. Is that what we ought to do?
Absolutely.
I mean, we ought to have cities that ought to be, if we have to have a lot of commercial stuff, then let's have it underground. And then let's have the trees. Let's live in the trees. Let's live like, we're both you and John and myself and we're lucky we were able to live out in the woods, but that's really the way I'd like to see most people be able to live. How can we somehow or other, if we can get people to understand that the time has come for them to live with nature, not against it. I wonder.
Well, there's so many things that can kind of come to mind when you put that out, and I totally agree with you. But one thing that's really, a lot of people are paying attention to it, Starhawk is teaching classes in it, and it's called permaculture. And it's interesting because it's the same, you know, when I'm reading about the recovery of culture, and she's talking about permaculture and the people that are teaching permaculture, it's all about agriculture and how that has to change. That's our relationship to the earth, is how we get our food. And so this thing that I'm reading in this book, which, you know, they're talking about the arboreal culture, and that's what they're talking about in permaculture, is that you plant trees, you plant fruit trees and you plant nut trees, and they give forth food that's harmless. They, you know, having the tree with the fruit that's freely given does no harm to the tree, and it does no harm to anybody, and it's like an ideal relationship between, you know, us doing kind of a minimal amount of work and then, you know, taking care of the trees, and then in the tree, in return, the trees feed us. And you were saying earlier about going up the Lost Coast and seeing these devastated clear cuts. And I wanted to just mention, and I think this is wonderful, you know, it's all about how you think of things. At the ancient country, which Thailand now they called Siam, trees were so sacred that people didn't like to cut them, and the job was reserved for criminals.
Yeah, well, I don't even want the criminals cutting them. Frankly, I'm not saying that you know, I'm not a what you would call a tree hugger, but on the other hand, I am a tree lover, and I just think that we've somehow or other, and here we are now. Look at it, consider this. Here we are desperately trying to find work for people. Right now we're nudging 15% unemployment in this country. And that's depression time. I mean, you know, that's bad. I don't want to go any further into the dangers of 15% employment, but believe me, it's a dangerous level. And we could put all these people to work reversing our trend here and put them to work on ecology-oriented projects that would be self-perpetuating and that would improve conditions for our children and our grandchildren, and we could put everybody to work. And why can't we, you know, I wonder why we can't do this. Why cleaning up the environment and developing new technologies that do not pollute and destroy and recycle. I don't want to go into politics, but doggone it, we should be able to do this. And we should be able to do it without reverting to something like Stalinism or something like that. We ought to be able to do it still within the context of the so-called private sector. Do you agree with me, or is there any hope for that?
I'm totally with you on this. And the thing which I'm kind of working towards, sort of dedicating my life towards, is creating positive future vision, you know, inviting people toward a future that's so beguiling, so enchanting, so beautiful that they want to move in that direction rather than any kind of power over. It has to have an allure. And I think that when people kind of in contact with these ideas that, you know, we can have this beautiful paradisal lifestyle, that it really is possible. We can plant trees and surround ourselves with the beauty of nature. It's our choice. We can do this, and we can celebrate these trees. And you say you're not a tree hugger, but I've heard you talking to trees, so don't tell me you haven't.
Well, all right, I've talked to trees. I know.
Admit it.
I know. I'll tell you a good story of that, though. I think Fred was with us at the time, Shelton and Fred and myself, and there was this fellow from back east. And I won't say what tradition he was because I don't want to, you know, insult his tradition or whatever. But he was from the tradition, and he was from back east. And he went over to a tree. It was a big, tall tree. And we were out in Chileo or somewhere out there like that. Here's Chileo. And he went over to this tree, and he hugged the tree. And it made it quite obvious to everybody that he was talking to the tree. And so we all looked at him, you know, talking to the tree. So then he came back. And very satisfied, and we asked him. I said, "Well, what did the tree communicate to you?" And he said, "Well, he said he was a sequoia, And he was very old, and, you know, he told us some more stuff about the tree. He was very nice. And so we thought that was all nice, and we nodded. And then after he left, Shelton turned around and said, well, you know, we shouldn't tell him, but those trees sometimes don't tell the truth, because actually it was a ponderosa.
Oh, dear.
But, yeah, so trees lied to it. But I just really, you know, in Robert Graves' White Goddess, we have the tree alphabet. And what's your tree in the tree alphabet? Or do you remember?
I don't.
When you say
what's my tree, I'm not sure that I know what you mean.
Yeah, there's 13 month tree calendar. I didn't mean to put you on the spot there because I forget the Hebrew alphabet sometimes. I got to go back and read it. But the tree alphabet. Everybody has a totem tree, a tree that's attributed to the alphabet. And Fred, let me go along the line of what you're saying here. In 1969. Fred wrote a little article called Paradisial Sanctuary. And he starts out and he says, whether or not megapolis and suburbia persist in the landscapes of the earth, one thing is certain. Alternate human natural environments and cognate life cycles and styles must and will spring up. The character and pace of mechanized milieus at their very best are not conducive to the holistic unfoldment of human potential. If there are no positive environmental and stylistic alternatives, very adequate negative alternatives are at present provided by our society. It is quite true, city, county, state, and national parks, monuments, and forests, but these, according to our lights, are not sufficient in view of the present cultural crisis of the world community. The positive alternative consists in a prototypal environment which we broadly define by the following complex of specifications. 1. The paradisial sanctuary must be established within an extensive region of undisturbed primordial wilderness. The human inhabitants of this sanctuary, permanent and transient, will maintain the primordial wilderness setting with unyielding strictness, and these custodians will be imbued with the truth that man's only privilege of power is to serve all nature. And this by leaving most of it alone. And for nature is superior to man or any other single strand of her grand fabric. And her right to exist could never be determined by man's use. Such a measure yields only derangement and chaos. Now, that's a little stiff, but basically, what he's saying is true. We are the air we breathe. I mean, if we don't have air, we're gone. And air is part of the planet. Air is part of nature. Trees produce oxygen. We're part of nature. We have to. We just have to learn to live with nature. But, Joe, you know, really, H.G. Wells figured out in 1920 that if we were going to do something like what Fred's talking about here, we'd need something like 45 million people on the whole planet, and any more than that, we couldn't do it. That was Wells' calculation. And right now, what are we doing? We're getting close to 7 billion?
Something like it, yeah.
Yeah. See, this is, we're almost going to, it's like we're going to have to sit here and wait for another horrible cataclysm before we can do this. And yet at the same time we have to start working toward it.
Well, I think that the fairy faith has a lot to offer here. I'm going to use this as my cue, because those images and those myths and those legends and traditions of fairy provide those archetypal images that we need. And knowing that they're there and thinking about them and using those as inspirations for how to live can give us the positive future vision that we need to be able to go, so that we have some place to go towards instead of just something to run away from.
Now, there I thoroughly agree with you. And what we need, at the first step in this process let's not say we have to have an apocalypse before we can do this. It may be true that we do, but let's be positive and say, okay, we're going to work toward it we're not working toward an apocalypse. We're going to try to do it anyway. We're going to try to and the first step is something like Ferroferia. I really believe it is. I believe that we need to get it revived and get people to really thinking along these lines. Because let's look at it. Let's take, for instance, Christianity. Christianity is the largest religion in the world. But nobody in Christianity really follows Jesus' teachings. Those that do are considered to be nuts by the real Christians.
Well, they elevate them to sainthood, and that's about it. Usually, they're dead by the time that happens.
And even they don't. Yeah. So consequently, we can certainly do with Ferroferia, so maybe it's unreasonable. Yes, but so is Christianity. and look how successful
they were.
People might
wonder on a really basic level, well, what does this mean? You know, what can I do with the idea of fairy? And one thing you can do, like now, like after the show, as in, you know, you finish listening to the show and you walk out your door and you find a park or a little place you can sit, or if you're lucky, you can sit under a tree or, you know, next to a stream if you're really lucky, and hang out. And we're, you know, it's evening, we're past twilight, we're getting into the first part of true darkness. And depending on where you're living in the world as you listen to this, but here where we're broadcasting from, and hang out, you know, take the chance. I mean, maybe you're going to be alone, and that's ideal, okay? Take the chance to sit there and listen, you know, smell, put your senses out, and you can call in the fairy. You can actually sit there and make yourself open to the fae, the great fae, the fae, that's the plural for fairy. And you can call on them. If you don't know their name, then you can call on them by, say, the great fae of the north. I invite you here. I welcome you. You can say it with your voice out loud. That's ideal. If you feel too self-conscious, just say it in your own mind. Make space for it. Let your vision become soft. You know, you don't look with a hard glance. You kind of let the edges of your perception be available so that if you see a little shimmer off your side, you don't stare at it and pin it down. You just allow it to be. Maybe that shimmer is that fairy presence coming to you, you know, or it can be a little a whistling or rustling in the trees. And maybe you don't have access to, like, trees and streams at all. You know, maybe when you go outside, what you have is your backyard. Fine. Sit in your backyard if that's what you have, or if it's just a plant that you can sit next to. All living things, all natural living plants, harbor bits of fae, bits of fairy that you can call these beings, and you can actually have a relationship with them. But if you don't call them, they're not going to come to you. You have to make yourself open first, relaxing.
Joe, we're running short of time. We got an hour slot tonight. I hate to interrupt you. You're just beautiful. But let's get them to get your video right now. That's Dancing with Gaia. And what's your website again? Tell us.
GaiaDancing.com is where you can see the trailer for the almost hour and a half long documentary film I made on Earth Energy, Sacred Sexuality, and the Return of the Goddess as Gaia. And it was completely informed and inspired by Fred Adams, who basically got me to make this film. And it embodies so much of the essence of Ferroferia and of the teachings of Fred and a lot of other wonderful mystic teachers that I interviewed for to make the film. So you can get
it's
that.
It's a wonderful film, and I want everybody to get it. Now, thanks a lot. Next week, next week we're doing Kerwin Falling Star, a wonderful novelist, a neo-pagan novelist, and she's published The Heart of Fire. And so Kerwin Falling Star next week, and meanwhile, good magic.